May it please the court, my name is Victor Boog, spelled B-O-O-G, attorney number 2561, appearing on behalf of the appellant, which at the moment is Dwight Ingram and Frederick Egan, the shareholders on behalf of Interstate Transportation, Inc., in a derivative suit. The suit actually began by Interstate Transportation, Inc., as a result of a decision by two of its three board members, namely Mr. Ingram and Mr. Egan, who at that time were two of the three board members. That became a matter of appeal to this court, and between the time this case was first initiated and today, there were decisions by the Court of Appeals and then a decision by the Supreme Court not to take cert, and the board, which at one time was five people, governed by Mr. Cudahy, his wife, and his son, is now back in the hands of my two clients, Dwight Ingram and Frederick Egan, who once again represent a majority of that board. We could potentially, I suppose, ask to amend the caption in this case to say it's just interstate based on a decision of the board, but we had nothing on our hands.
This is all post the appeal, apparently.
Yes.
My understanding is that at the time the briefs were filed and so forth, the company was controlled by Mr. Cuddy.
That's right. That's changed since this appeal.
Is that relevant to anything we're going to say?
I don't think it really is today. And I'll get back to the issues at hand. I don't think there's any dispute that the claim made by Ingram and Egan in the earlier case, 2009 case, was a claim made for their own benefit, and it was a claim that said Mr. Cuddy has been taking distributions, portions of which are ours, because he never paid for his additional stock in the company. That was the only issue in the case, and it was ruled against my clients. The ruling was interesting, however, because it said that $125,000 of the monies that Mr. Cuddy had given ITI over time were attributable to his capital account that required payment for his extra shares. The irony was that at the time Mr. Cudahy was arguing and finally convinced the court that $125,000 of the monies he had given the company should be attributed to his stock purchase, he was also paying himself interest and replacement of the principal on the same $125,000.
So are there essentially two separate income streams going into Mr. Cudahy's pocket? One is distributions or dividends, essentially.
Correct.
And another is interest on the loans, and your theory is he can't get both.
Exactly. And
when dividends were distributed to him, they were also distributed to the other shareholders.
Yes. And our shareholders said we should have gotten more of those dividends because we never paid for the extra stock as it was supposed to. The court found that, notwithstanding that he didn't meet all the criteria of getting the extra stock, the court said, I'm declaring that $125,000 of the money to the advance of the company are for stock and nothing else. And we don't challenge that in the case subsequently brought in 2011 after thus settled in the earlier case that was finalized in 2010. In 2011, in January, the company, ITI, brought a claim against Mr. Cuddy for recovery of all this extra interest and payments of principal that he was giving himself on a non-existent loan balance with the company. We also complained in the complaint on which this case is predicated, that he also, after the fact, realized, or his accountant realized, that he couldn't do that, so then he tried to attribute it to and classify it as consulting fees. Tens of thousands of dollars in consulting fees. Problem with that is that the company had no basis for needing any consulting and never authorized any consulting, and that also is a claim in the case. The original judge in the case, who's now retired, Judge Berryhill, initially determined that this case should be dismissed, on a motion to dismiss, and he said so as a reason that this case, the present case, the rights and shares attributable to which are now in dispute. Well, he said that was the same claim that we had in the other case. In fact, there's no such claims made in this case. We know that $125,000 is attributable to his purchase of stock, and we don't quibble about that. That went up on appeal. It was returned to Judge Berryhill because Judge Berryhill made that determination without having the full record before him. And the Court of Appeals said that was incorrect. Sent it back, had the record made part of the record before the judge, which it was, and then had the judge reconsider and rule again. Came back on appeal and ruled that the issues were not the same in this case as in the other case, and he was wrong in dismissing the case in the first instance. Some months later, because of the, I said, flip-flopping back and forth on this issue and other issues before Judge Berryhill, Mr. Cuddy's counsel asked Judge Berryhill to reconsider. This is a motion to reconsider after Judge Berryhill had ruled in my client's ITI's favor, had set the matter for trial, had directed that an answer be filed. All of a sudden, there's this motion to reconsider, and by golly, he reconsidered. And he ruled this time that I guess I was wrong on remand when I said that these cases were different. And I'm going back to my original ruling, which I dismissed way back in June of 2000.
This is all very interesting, but isn't the case barred by statute of limitations? And if not, why not?
Lots of reasons why not. The main reasons are that Judge Berryhill thought the statute of limitations were 2 years. He also just assumed that all the things that we alleged in the complaint in this case occurred at least 2 years prior to the filing of the case.
Well, the statute of limitations is 3 years, and almost all but one occurs prior to the filing of this case.
Not true. When we look at this case and the pleadings on the face of the complaint, my clients didn't find out about the double dipping that Mr. Cuddy was doing until 2009. That's alleged in the complaint. The complaint was filed on January 19th, 2011, well within a 3-year statutory limit. The case law with respect to statutory limits when you're on a motion to dismiss or summary judgment, not quite the same after what it would be after a full trial. You have to have, as the courts said himself, it has to be obvious from the bare allegations on the complaint that this is outside the statute of limitations. I submit when you look at the bare allegations in the complaint that it's not outside the 3-year window. The other thing is that as if you had looked at the complaint in this case, the amounts that we talk about, at least through 2009, are rather specific, almost to the penny. In those cases, there's statutory authority that says there may be a 6-year statute of limitations. Now, I didn't plead that in the initial pleading for ITI in January of 2011. But when faced with the possibility that Judge Berryhill was going to dismiss this case or dismiss it on summary judgment, I asked for leave to amend to state that fact because this case involves things that have not just started in 2005, they're continuing to this day. It's not in this record because we haven't had a trial. But the fact of the matter is, nothing's really changed. Mr. Cudahy continues to take interest. He took it in 2005. In 2005, if we looked at the books and took away $125,000 for capital investment and extra stock, he was upside down in August of 2005. That didn't slow him down in 2005. It didn't slow him down in 2006. It didn't slow him down in 2007. It didn't slow him down in 2008. And it didn't slow him down in 2009 or thereafter.
Counsel, let me interpose a question here. In terms of pleading requirements, is there any requirement that a plaintiff allege facts that would indicate that the discovery rule is implicated somehow in terms of discovering wrongdoing? And so, for example, if your complaint alleged that you, something that happened in 2009, are you required to allege something that indicates you couldn't have discerned that earlier?
Well, in fact, I did allege that we could not have discerned it earlier or didn't. And,
well, the didn't is a big word.
Yes.
I mean, your clients were shareholders and on the board.
Yes.
They presumably attended board meetings. They presumably had access to the financials of the corporation.
Those presumptions should not be made in this case, because that is not what happened. And if we get to trial, that'll be demonstrated in spades. That's the problem with this case. It was done on summary judgment or motion for dismissal. I'm not saying that Mr. Cuddy isn't going to argue statute of limitations when the case is before the court at the trial court level. What I'm saying is that I think we can win those arguments hands down, because Mr. Cuddy was doing all these things without notice to anybody.
And was that pled?
Was pled that we didn't know about it. Black and white. It's in my brief. All those pleadings are in the brief. So this is a case, in my opinion, that first of all had no business being thrown out because it was res judicata or plain. The argument was not that these parties had the same interest, because they didn't. The argument was, well, this was an issue that could have been raised in the original trial and wasn't. That's the argument that was made on page 12 of my opening brief. I say, as stated in the trial court's order, March 27, 2014, plain preclusion bars relitigation of matters that have already been decided in the prior proceeding. That's not an issue here. We can see what happened in the earlier proceeding, as well as matters that could have been raised in a prior proceeding but were not. Those are the magic words that are relied upon by opposing counsel.
So why couldn't you have raised the improper interest payments in the first case as an alternative theory to your improper dividend case?
My clients were Mr. Egan and Mr. Ingram. They felt they'd been shorted on distributions. My job was to try that case for them. If I was going to then, in the alternative, say, or the company is entitled to all this interest, that's in direct contrast to what I was arguing on their behalf. It would have been, in my opinion, a breach of my obligation to my clients to be arguing something just the opposite.
And well, I mean, that's... That's in part a trial tactic perception, and it may be a legal ethics perception on which I'm not an expert, but is the principle, the res judicata principle, that incorporates not only claims that were made, but claims that could have been raised, subject to either countervailing tactical considerations, because you can plead things in the alternative, or the conflict of interest legal ethics principle?
Here's what I think that language means, as well as matters that could have been raised. By the same people for the same party. There was no...
RTI
was not a party in this case.
But it didn't take you very long to solve that problem in the second case, just by bringing a derivative claim
wasn't even a derivative claim when it started.
You solved the problem by bringing the claims derivative.
Yes.
So, which you could have done that in the first case.
I couldn't have done it and made the argument for my clients if they were shortchanged on distributions.
Well, you could have made it in the alternative.
Not on their behalf. The only claim they had personally was that they didn't get the distribution portions that they were entitled to. And that was all I was hired to do, and that's all I was paid to do.
They got the dividends when the dividends were paid.
They were paid at times different from the times when Mr. Cudahy was paying in self-interest on a non-existing loan. And that's evident from the documentation in the cases. The dividends were paid about mostly about 2005 and thereafter. The interest that he was paying himself on this $125,000 was ongoing from 2003 on. Never stopped. But the dividends, they didn't come until later. And they were in different amounts. So there is no common issue in these cases. And all the cases in my brief make it pretty clear to me that this is not a case for saying that this was, you had to bring these cases on behalf of the IVI, which wasn't a party in the case, or it was too late after that. And my sense of it is that until the judge actually ruled in the earlier case in the summer of 2010, we had every reason to believe that he had been wrongfully taking distributions.
I think you're
right. Only after the judge ruled in 2010 that it was clear that it was just the opposite.
Your time is exhausted.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Lauren Thompson on behalf of the appellees. I'd like to address this issue of whether or not a claim could have been brought in the prior proceeding. What Mr. Bugo omits from his argument is the fact that plaintiff's theory of the case in Cudahy 1 was in support of their allegation for civil theft, that Mr. Cudahy tricked them into thinking he had paid $125,000 to ITI as a capital contribution to purchase the additional stock, when they alleged that in reality what he was doing was treating this sum as a loan because he had purportedly taken principal payments on it as if it were a loan and paid himself interest as if the amount were a loan, and by allegedly reclassifying certain of these payments as consulting fees. These are the exact claims that the plaintiffs are now attempting to prosecute in Cudahy 2.
But isn't a threshold question to your analysis who gets the money back? In other words, if the company improperly or fraudulently somehow paid interest to Mr. Cudahy to which he was not entitled, if the company wins that case, doesn't the interest go back to the company?
It does, Your Honor.
Okay, and let's go back to Cudahy 1. The other gentleman alleged that there were dividend or distributions disproportionate to the stock interest because Mr. Cudahy hadn't paid for the stock, basically. Isn't that money that if they were to have won would go to them?
No, Your Honor. And the reason is there are a few, actually. The first being the way the stock transaction was actually papered to go down was there were three separate contracts. One was between Mr. Ingram and ITI, by which Mr. Ingram was paid a certain amount of money from ITI, and he sold back a certain portion of his original one-third share of the company to the back to ITI. Mr. Ingram had a similar deal where he actually owed money to ITI, and ITI forgave his loan in exchange for Mr. Ingram putting certain of his stock back into the company. And then Mr. Cudahy had a third contract with ITI where ITI was going to issue those relinquished shares to Mr. Cudahy in exchange for the $125,000. So to the extent Mr. Cudahy may have failed to pay the $125,000, the stock that he was claiming was actually Treasury stock at that point in time. It wasn't stock belonging to Ingram and Egan, because as the trial court found in Cudahy 1, those transactions between Ingram and Egan in Cudahy 1 had already been completed, and they had already received the benefit of their bargain from their relinquishment of their shares. So if plaintiffs had prevailed in the first case, what actually would have happened was any excess distributions that Mr. Cuddy had received would have happily gone back to the company, which is why Judge Berryhill correctly found in the first case that even though Ingram and Egan thought that they were claiming dividends for their own benefit, what they were actually doing was representing the interests of the company, because it was really the company's money that they were claiming Mr. Cuddy had wrongfully taken.
Well, that's not the theory on which they proceeded, however. That was the Judge Berryhill's after-the-fact recharacterization.
Well, Your Honor, actually, I wouldn't say it's entirely accurate to say the theory on which they proceeded was that Mr. Cuddy harmed them by overpaying himself distributions. Really, that was their damages. What they said was, you wrongfully accounted for this $125,000 by overpaying yourself interest and principal on your loan that otherwise would have been negative, and you made us think that you had paid in the $125,000. Our damages are, you ultimately helped yourself to excess distributions as if you paid the money.
I apologize, my question was probably awkward. Their theory of damages was they being two individual shareholders, get the improper distribution.
Correct? Yes, John.
Okay. So maybe they're wrong, and Judge Berryhill so concluded, but that seems to me that's a different question than saying, could they as individuals have prosecuted a claim on the alternative theory that if it really had been a capital contribution, then the interest payments are improper?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the elements of claim preclusion require us to go that far in order to establish that claim preclusion would bar the second case.
Well, how could Ingram and the other gentlemen in their own names directly recover improper interest payments made by the company?
Ingram and Egan, when you say in their own names, they were actually prosecuting Cuddy 1 in the capacity as shareholders of the company.
Well, that's what I meant, but not as a derivative action. They were bringing individual claims for which they had standing as shareholders.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, let's look at the improper interest theory. Could an individual, not as a derivative action, but as an individual action, is a shareholder entitled to recover from a third party improper interest payments made by the corporation to that third party?
The harm would be to the corporation, so that would have to be a derivative claim.
Okay, well, it doesn't inform us as to how the claims that could have been brought analysis has to be looked at. In other words, they are individual plaintiffs in case one. I think we agree that as individual plaintiffs in case one, they couldn't recover improper interest paid by the company. So how is that a claim they could have brought in case one?
Your Honor, I think what you're getting at is the privity question. And the answer is that there's not only privity between Ingram and Egan and Cuddy 1, but there's also identity of the plaintiffs now. So I think the answer to the court's question is actually wrapped up in Mr. Boob's representation that Ingram and Egan have this ability to go back and forth between bringing claims derivatively and bringing claims directly on behalf of the corporation. In Cuddy 1, Ingram and Egan were attempting to recover damages in their capacity as shareholders of ITI.
But not on behalf of ITI.
Not on behalf of ITI, but in their capacity as shareholders. A derivative action, and the derivative action that they have maintained now, is still in their capacity as shareholders of ITI.
But if they succeed, the money goes to the company in a derivative action.
Yes, Your Honor.
In an individual action, if they were to succeed, it goes to the shareholders.
But I don't agree with the premise that shareholders bringing a claim in their capacity as shareholders for their own benefit and shareholders bringing a claim in their capacity as shareholders for the benefit of the company fundamentally changes the capacity in which they're bringing a claim.
Doesn't it fundamentally change who gets the money if they win?
It changes where the damages go, but it doesn't change the hat they're wearing, and that's what the doctrine of claim preclusion looks at.
But as a derivative action, don't they have a fiduciary obligation to the corporation? And they don't have in their individual action?
Well, they were also, you have to keep in mind, this is a closely held corporation. So these two guys were also
Does that make a difference?
It does, because they have fiduciary duties to the company even in their capacity as shareholders, because they're also directors of a closely held corporation. And what the law says is a company is bound by any action taken by its shareholders with regard to the bringing of a lawsuit, because the company's in privity with its shareholders, unless there's a reason to carve out privity because of the interests of a shareholder that was not involved in the lawsuit. And in this case, every single ownership interest in ITI participated in the first lawsuit. So all of the interest in ITI was actually represented in Cudahy 1. So ITI, the standard for privity is, was the company, were the interests of the non-party virtually represented in the first litigation? And I think it's a very clear case of the fact that it was virtually represented, because despite the fact that Ingram even thought money was going into their own pockets, every single effort that they made in order to obtain that relief was actually on behalf of the company and was actually for the company's benefit, because their interests were aligned with the company, regardless of the fact that they thought that they were getting the payout and they weren't.
And the fact that ITI was the party in the first action is, in your view, irrelevant.
It's not that it's irrelevant, Your Honor. It's that it doesn't defeat the possibility that they could have named ITI in the first action. And in fact, according to the trial court, they should have. That would have been the proper way to proceed on even the relief that they were seeking.
But doesn't, I mean, I appreciate the concept, and you've articulated it precisely, but doesn't that impose a fairly heavy burden on people in the position of Mr. Boog's clients, in that they have to say, well, we think we've got a claim to put these improper dividends back in our pocket directly, but maybe the company has a derivative claim to go after a separate stream of improper payments, and we better bring both, otherwise we're going to be foreclosed by claim preclusion.
Well, here's why this case is unique in that facet, Your Honor, and that's because they were actually litigating the exact same transactions in Cudahy 1 that are now at issue in Cudahy 2. As I pointed out, let me back up a little bit. Their one claim in Cudahy 1 was a claim for civil theft. In order to establish civil theft, they had to establish that Mr. Cudahy had an intent to deceive them. Their theory about how Mr. Cudahy intended to deceive them was by allegedly treating the $125,000 as a loan rather than as a capital contribution. And the evidence of the fact that he treated it as a loan was he otherwise would have been paying himself interest and principal on a non-existent loan account. So what they did was, in Cudahy 1, they brought a civil theft claim and said, here's how you tried to deceive us. And the court said, Mr. Cudahy was disclosing everything on the company's books and records. I don't find he had intent to deceive you, but if he did something wrong with regard to his accounting, that was a claim you could have brought on behalf of the company. So now
I'm not sure that would be binding in any event, but did Judge Berryhill say you could have brought it on behalf of the company, or did he simply say that the proceeds of that claim would belong to the company? In other words, the wrong plaintiff, the right plaintiff is not informed.
He said there's no claim here for monies had and received from the corporation or breach of fiduciary duty, and that those claims would have belonged to ITI. So he actually pointed out that they could have brought claims for breach of fiduciary duty and could have brought claims for monies hadn't received from the corporation.
I want to change the subject for just a moment here. You've appealed in part the denial of your motion to dismiss, and I'm just trying to discern on what basis would we have jurisdiction to entertain a denial of a motion to dismiss.
That is an alternative basis for the court to affirm the trial court's judgment. So I think that the court can look at the case has ultimately been dismissed. So if the court finds that the trial court had a different reason that it could have dismissed the case, or a proper reason having rejected claim preclusion and the statute of limitations, then I think that the court can affirm the dismissal because ITI had asked for the case to be dismissed.
Was there a specific finding in Cudahy 1 that the plaintiffs had access to the books and records of the corporation?
There was, Your Honor. Ingram and Egan both.
Is that germane to this proceeding at all?
It is, because they've argued that their case isn't barred by the statute of limitations because they've pled that Mr. Cuddihy never disclosed these transactions and they didn't know about them until 2009. Judge Berryhill actually tried both of those allegations and found the opposite. What he found was Mr. Cuddihy has been always been disclosing these transactions on the company's books and records dating back to as early as 2005, and Ingram and Egan should have known about all of the allegations giving rise to their claims, including specifically these alleged payments of principal and interest on his non-existent loan balance. And so what they've done here is they took their theory of deception from Cuddihy 1 and pulled it out and said, okay, we lost on the underlying property, we didn't get those distributions, but now we actually want to say we have new damages arising from the deception that we tried before. And I mean, that's really where we are. And so the importance of applying res judicata in this case is, while they've said that the judgment that they're seeking is actually consistent with the judgment in Cuddihy 1, that couldn't be farther from true. There's no way that they could prevail on their civil theft claim in a judgment that's consistent with the trial court's order in Cuddihy 1, because the trial court already found that Mr. Cuddihy had no intent to deceive them. They also couldn't possibly prevail on their remaining claims, because the trial court already found that Mr. Cuddihy was disclosing these transactions in as early as 2005, and thus plaintiffs should have known about them, and they're asking for relief dating back to as early as 2000, based on transactions dating back to as early as 2005, on the premise that they're claiming, again, that they didn't know about it. So both of those issues have been litigated, and both of those issues have been settled. So it's not true at all that there's no risk of an inconsistent judgment when the very judgment they're asking for is inconsistent.
Is that a claim preclusion argument, or is it an issue preclusion argument? In other words, the distinction I'm trying to draw, and your answer is probably going to run you over the red line. It seems to me one thing to say their claim is precluded, and I've expressed some concerns about that. It might be a different question to say the issue, an issue on which they must win to prevail, is precluded by determinations in the prior court, in the prior case.
Yes, Your Honor. And my response to that is there's an important reason why claim preclusion and issue preclusion both exist, in that they're narrower, one is narrower than the other in some respects, and one is broader than the other in some respects. And here we really are talking about a question of claim preclusion, because we're talking about relitigation of the exact same transactions that were already decided in Cuddihy 1 and claims for damages that could have been brought in Cuddihy 1.
That sounds more like issue preclusion than claim preclusion.
It's claims that could have been brought in the prior litigation. Issue preclusion is actually arguably not available for any of the issues in this case for two reasons. One is the plaintiffs have argued there's no privity among the parties. Well, if they're right, issue preclusion requires privity, and issue preclusion couldn't be asserted by either party. The other reason is the Supreme Court has actually observed, excuse me, let me just find the citation. In the case of Stanton v. Schultz, which is 222 P3rd 303, call of 2010, that comment I to the restatement second of judgment, section 27, provides that if a trial court enters judgment on two or more issues, each of which would independently be sufficient to sustain the judgment, then a second litigation may not bar the relitigation of any of those issues. And the Supreme Court actually in that case declined to weigh in on whether or not it would adopt this second restatement approach, but it did observe that many jurisdictions do. And so the trial court's judgment in Cuddihy 1 was actually based in the alternative on the expiration of the statute of limitations, the economic loss rule, Mr. Cuddihy's lack of intent to deceive, and its finding that Mr. Cuddihy had paid in the $125,000 for stock as a capital contribution and thus properly acquired a two-thirds interest. Arguably, under the restatement approach, every single one of those issues is subject to relitigation in Cuddihy 2, because all of them would have supported the trial court's judgment equally.
I think your time, we appreciate the lengthy answer to Judge Terry's questions. I think
your
time's exhausted. We appreciate the arguments of counsel. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Counsel are excused.
that exhausts the morning docket, and the bail may not resist.